Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to an update on FARA Compliance and Enforcement conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to Rob Kelner, Chairman of Covington's Political Law Practice Group. Please go ahead, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Covington's update for clients and other friends of the firm concerning the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA. I'm Rob Kelner. I chair the firm's political law practice, and I'm a partner in the firm's white-collar defense and investigations practice group. I'm joined by my partner, Brian Smith. Brian is a member of the firm's public policy and political law practice groups. Together, we've been advising clients on FARA compliance matters and defending clients in FARA investigations for two decades. Covington has one of the country's oldest and largest FARA practices. We've litigated FARA cases in the federal courts. We're currently defending clients in several public and non-public Department of Justice FARA investigations. We've also dealt very extensively for many years with the FARA Registration Unit, an office within the DOJ's National Security Division, which administers FARA. We have listeners on the line today with a range of experience levels concerning FARA, from beginners to experts. So we're going to start with an overview of the statute's basic requirements. Then we'll discuss some of the key exemptions to FARA registration, which often present the most difficult judgment calls. Along the way, we're going to reference some of the advisory opinions concerning FARA that DOJ released for the first time in 2018. And then we will finish up by updating you on enforcement trends, including the recent widely publicized FARA non-prosecution agreement that the law firm Skadden entered into with the Department of Justice, and will suggest a number of key elements for a corporate FARA compliance program. To start us off, let me ask Brian Smith to provide an overview of what FARA is and what the basic triggers are for FARA registration. Brian?
Thanks, Rob. FARA is a criminal statute, and its premise is to require registration and disclosure of certain activities undertaken for a foreign interest. It was enacted back in the 1930s. At that time, it was focused on the disclosure of propaganda and concern about disclosing propagandists working in the United States in the run-up to World War II. In the 60s, it was amended to focus primarily on lobbying and public relations-type work. And then it was significantly amended again in 1995, when Congress made a decision to put private sector lobbying primarily under the Lobbying Disclosure Act and to leave FARA focused on governmental lobbying. But as we'll talk a little bit today, they left some rough edges around as they made those changes. FARA is a dangerous combination because it has really sweeping applicability of its terms, relatively widespread misunderstanding of its scope, and moderate obscurity. It's become more notable of recent with some high-profile prosecutions and cases. I want to talk about the triggers for the registration requirement. There are basically three components to triggering FARA or considering whether FARA has been triggered. The first is a relationship analysis related to an agent in the United States and a foreign principal outside the United States. The second component relates to the activities. FARA only covers certain specified activities, although the terms of its scope are fairly broad. And then lastly, Rob will cover the exemptions, which is the third component of considering whether FARA has been triggered. The triggers are overlapping and interrelated. They're highly fact-specific. As you'll see as we talk about it today, small changes in facts can have big changes in the applicability of the law. It goes so far even to have two events or activities that may look the same entirely from the outside, and one can trigger the statute and one does not, depending on how those activities come into place. I want to stress also, because of this highly fact-specific nature of FARA, that this is an overview of the requirements, and the particular application of FARA to a particular set of circumstances should be examined carefully. First, I want to talk about that relationship component. FARA covers activities conducted by an agent inside the United States on behalf of a foreign principal outside the United States. And a foreign principal is anyone outside the United States. Although people typically think of FERA in terms of foreign governments, and it does apply there, of course, FERA also applies to individuals, political parties, partnerships, associations, corporations, organizations, literally any entity or person outside the United States. Then with respect to the agent's activities need to be inside the United States. And the way one becomes an agent under FERA is by acting at the order or direction or control of that person outside the United States. At its broadest, FERA even encompasses activities conducted at the request of somebody outside the United States. And it also covers activities in the United States that are subsidized or financed in whole or major part by someone outside the United States. This relationship component of FERA is fairly complicated and highly fact-specific, as I mentioned before, and there is not a lot of case law on the question of control for an agent in the United States, but there is some case law, and some of it is helpful. For example, there's case law holding that simply having the same viewpoint as somebody outside the United States is not in and of itself control. Separately, someone may be acting inside the United States in their own interest in a way that benefits somebody outside the United States, and that in and of itself also would not constitute control. There's also, as I mentioned, where the statute is at its broadest with the term request, there's also helpful case law basically concluding that it can't just be any request whatsoever. It has to be some request that comes along with surrounding circumstances where the person taking the action in the United States feels that they need to take the action or they're somehow authorized to act on behalf of the foreign principal. And lastly, there's some helpful case law on bona fide subsidies. Because the statute does cover activities that are financed or subsidized by a foreign principal, this case law is helpful because it shows that a bona fide grant that doesn't come with the ability to control the person's activities in the United States is not going to give rise to a FERA obligation. The question of control is also subject to some very interesting current cases. There's a case right now pending in court related to Russian media and a radio station in the United States that leased airtime to this Russian media organization. In the pleadings, the station has taken the position that it's not an agent of the Russian media. It's simply someone who is providing a commercial lease of airtime. And it'll be interesting to see how the court addresses this issue and if there's some additional case law on the question of control. I next want to turn to the second component of FERA, and that is the activities that are covered by FERA. There are four activities specified in the statute that lead to a registration requirement. The first is engaging in what the statute calls political activities, and that's a defined term, and I'll come back to that one in a second. The second activity is generally around advice, public relations advice, political consulting advice, acting as a publicity agent, what the statute calls an information service employee. The third aspect really focuses on money. And anytime you are collecting, that is fundraising in the United States on behalf of someone outside the United States, or dispersing money or other things of value within the United States, that activity is implicated. And then the fourth is what people generally think of with respect to FERA, and that is representing the interests of the foreign principal before the U.S. government. That would include lobbying and other activities where you're engaging directly with the U.S. government, whether Congress or an agency or any other U.S. government entity. So that's the one people generally think of with respect to FERA. They think of lobbying. But as I noted, it's much broader. So consider, for example, political activity, and let's focus on that. Political activity under the statute is any activity that you believe or intend will influence the U.S. government or the U.S. public on a question of policy. So political activity generally goes to influencing the government or public on policy, and it doesn't require direct contacts with the government as, for example, the Lobbying Disclosure Act would. So those are the four activities that are implicated in FERA. And I would note that I didn't say that you need to have a contract. Note that we didn't say you need to have a payment. Those four activities implicate FERA regardless of whether there is a contract or payment. To focus a little on the kinds of activities that are important for FERA, I want to talk a little bit about the Skadden settlement that Rob mentioned. Looking at the settlement documents in a close read, you will see that the settlement focuses extensively on the public relations coordination, the contacts that were made with reporters, and the contacts that were made with lobbyists. And this is important because it goes to those kinds of activities that can trigger FERA, both with respect to political activity, that is, seeking to influence the U.S. public on a matter of policy, and also the second trigger, the second activity trigger related to public relations advice and counsel. The Skadden settlement also shows the importance of ensuring that the facts match the legal structure. According to the settlement, Skadden's contract said that it would not implicate FERA and that Skadden would operate independently and not as an agent of any foreign individual or government. But the settlement then goes on to point out the acts that were undertaken by the law firm and where those differ. The Skadden settlement also shows how small changes in those facts can lead to big outcomes, big differences in legal outcomes. Lastly, if we talk, you recall I mentioned there are three components of the FERA analysis, the first being a relationship, the second being the activities. And now I will turn to Rob to talk about the key exemptions to FERA and the limitations on those exemptions.
Thanks, Brian. Brian has explained the triggers for FERA registration, which are very broad. Registration can be triggered without any foreign government as a client. It can be triggered without any written contract or payment of a fee. It can be triggered by providing advice to a foreign principal, even if you are not directly lobbying for the foreign principal. But fortunately, there are several key exemptions to FERA, which you might think of as off-ramps. They allow you to avoid the need to register. The catch is that these exemptions in FERA itself and in DOJ regulations are notoriously vague. Their outer boundaries are not well-defined. And until last year, there was almost no published guidance by the Department of Justice concerning the meaning of those exemptions. In 2018, DOJ began publishing heavily redacted versions of advisory opinions that it has issued since 2010, some of which do deal with interpreting the FERA exemptions. Let me summarize the exemptions that are most frequently invoked. First and foremost is the commercial exemption. This exemption has evolved over the years, both in its statutory form and in a regulation issued by the Department of Justice. The commercial exemption in the statute exempts private and non-political activities in furtherance of the bona fide trade or commerce of a foreign principal. In other words, commercial activities that don't involve influencing policy or public opinion regarding policy. In 2003 regulations, the department added a second regulatory commercial exemption that covers political activities undertaken for a foreign corporation in furtherance of the bona fide commercial, industrial, or financial operations of that foreign corporation. There remains, however, considerable uncertainty regarding the boundaries of this regulatory commercial exemption. Critically, it does not apply when the political activities are directed by a foreign government or foreign political party. And by the way, DOJ interprets the term political party quite broadly and more broadly than we normally would in plain English. And the regulatory commercial exemption does not apply if the political activities, quote, directly promote the public or political interests of a foreign government or foreign political party. That's critical language because it's far from clear what would count as directly promoting the interests of a foreign government. DOJ regulations expressly provide that the commercial exemption is available even to state-owned enterprises that are wholly owned by a foreign government. Though presumably, if the state-owned enterprise's political activities were directed by a foreign government, whatever that would look like, the activity would fall outside of the commercial exemption. There are a handful of published DOJ advisory opinions concerning the commercial exemption, most of which were written at a time when DOJ probably did not expect that they would ever be published, considering that for the first 80 years or so that the statute was on the books, advisory opinions were not published. Those opinions tend to be very sparse on facts and law generally, but we've noticed that more recent opinions, particularly the ones issued last year, after DOJ adopted a policy of publicly releasing the opinions, are more fleshed out and detailed. A notable example is an important opinion on the commercial exemption that was issued recently in November of 2018, and which is the most detailed opinion that we've seen yet interpreting the commercial exemption. That opinion was sought by a U.S. company that intended to handle media relations in the United States on behalf of a foreign state-owned company to promote a conference. DOJ noted that promotional materials to be used by the U.S. firm were inherently political in nature because they included a statement regarding, quote, foreign government industry leadership, end quote, and even a statement that the U.S. company would author op-eds on behalf of a foreign government. So it's not exactly clear what that means in context. Quite significantly, DOJ noted that the U.S. company's support of the foreign country's public interests would be, quote, indirect through the filter of the state-owned company, end quote. DOJ said that the benefits of the political activities to the foreign government would be, quote, indirect, as long as the foreign government refrained from directing any of the U.S. company's activities. Therefore, the commercial exemption applied and registration was not required. In other words, the department seemed to interpret the commercial exemption's directly promote language quite narrowly, placing an emphasis on whether there was direct involvement by the foreign government. And the department made clear that even government ownership of the foreign principal was not tantamount to direct involvement by a foreign government. It remains to be seen where this leads and whether this opinion points to a clearer, more practical, and broader application of the commercial exemption to FARA. But certainly this is an opinion that will be cited widely by FARA practitioners. Another commonly invoked exemption is the Lobbying Disclosure Act, or LDA, exemption to FARA. It exempts an organization from FARA registration if the organization registers instead under the LDA. To qualify for this exemption, the foreign principal must not be a foreign government or foreign political party, and the organization must engage in at least some actual lobbying activities within the United States on behalf of the principal. But there is an additional requirement that is not at all well defined in the regulations. That is the requirement that to rely on the LDA exemption, an organization must demonstrate that no foreign government or political party is, quote, the principal beneficiary of the activity at issue. There's really no available definition of what principal beneficiary means. One would think that a foreign government or party is, that it means that a foreign government or political party is the main beneficiary, receiving the bulk of the benefit. But like the directly promotes language in the commercial exemption, this is all very much still in the eye of the beholder. Interestingly, there is a January 5, 2018 advisory opinion on the LDA exemption that seems to read the principal beneficiary language as depending on whether the U.S. company is directed to engage in political activities by a foreign government. This echoes the approach that DOJ took in the November 2018 commercial exemption opinion I just mentioned. So while we don't have enough data points yet, it does seem that the department is leaving U.S. firms more latitude in these recent opinions to invoke the commercial and LDA exemptions in circumstances where it's clear that there is no direct foreign government involvement in the political activities, even when there may be some benefits to the foreign government. For law firms, a highly relevant exemption is the so-called lawyer's exemption, but it is much narrower than its name implies. It does not apply to a lawyer's attempt to influence agency personnel with respect to U.S. government policy matters or the public interests of a foreign government, except in the course of judicial proceedings, criminal or civil law enforcement inquiries or proceedings, and agency proceedings that are required by law to be conducted on the record. The intent behind this lawyer's exemption appears to be to require registration by law firms when they act more as lobbyists, public relations advisors, or political consultants than as legal counselors. In general, we advise law firms to construe this exemption as applying only to work performed in U.S. agency proceedings as defined in the statute and regulations. Finally, there is the academic exemption. This exempts registration for certain academic, scholastic, and arts-related activities. It's often relied upon by think tanks. But here, too, it's very important to note that the exemption does not apply to political activities as defined in the statute, suggesting a rather narrow scope. There is very little available guidance regarding the academic exemption. It's been relied upon by universities, think tanks, and other non-governmental organizations. But it's important to recognize that of the various exemptions, in some respects, this is the one that is least well defined by guidance or case law. Let me just say a few words about the enforcement trends that we're seeing, and then Brian is going to discuss FARA compliance programs. There's a bit of a myth that the current surge in FARA enforcement originated with the special counsel's investigation of the Trump administration. Actually, we saw the first signs of this trend in 2014 and 2015, and even earlier to some extent, with a significant uptick in the number of audits being conducted by the Department of Justice of existing FARA registrants. That's because once you register under the statute, the Department of Justice has very broad authority to come in and review all of your records related to the FARA registration. And those audits were conducted very rarely prior to 2014. They've been happening much more frequently since then. Around that same time, we saw indications that the FARA Registration Unit was taking a more aggressive posture on some matters, particularly with respect to their interpretation of the exemptions to FARA. We later learned that around the same time, the Department of Justice's Inspector General had opened up a review of the FARA Registration Unit, which led to a report in 2016 that was somewhat critical of the unit and particularly critical of the level of enforcement activity and perhaps how aggressive the unit had been with respect to enforcement activity. It aired for the first time some concerns within the Federal Bureau of Investigation concerning how difficult FBI agents thought it was to get a FARA investigation cleared through the Department of Justice. And so this IG report really put a lot of pressure on the department, and in particular on the FARA Registration Unit, to step up both publicly and non-publicly its enforcement activity. And we think that no doubt this is a significant factor in stimulating the upsurge in enforcement that followed. Today, there are several pending FARA investigations that are not, so far as anybody can tell, related to the Mueller investigation. That's in addition to FARA investigations known to have originated in the special counsel's office. Moreover, FARA investigations are not originating solely out of the National Security Division in which the FARA unit sits. There are signs that the Public Integrity Section and Main Justice and U.S. Attorney's offices are getting into the act as well. In short, FARA enforcement is not going away. In fact, it shows every sign of continuing to escalate under the Trump administration. Pending legislation in Congress could potentially broaden FARA and may provide DOJ with new enforcement tools, such as the ability to issue civil investigative demands. With that, let me ask Brian to wrap things up with a discussion of FARA compliance programs. Brian?
So I'm going to cover some of the best practices that we recommend in terms of FARA compliance. As you might imagine, given Rob's description of the enforcement environment, many companies, associations, firms, and others are rethinking their FARA compliance, putting in place stronger controls, and perhaps revisiting exemptions that they relied on in the past to see whether they need to tailor their activities in a slightly different way, given the shifting landscape with respect to the exemptions and their limitations. So who might this apply to? This could apply to companies with a foreign parent or companies with a foreign affiliate for whom they are engaged in activities and support in the United States. It can apply to public relations firms, law firms, consulting firms, and other firms that have foreign clients. It can apply to trade associations that have foreign members or who are engaged in lobbying on issues that implicate foreign entities, foreign governments, and foreign interests. And really, it can apply to any other organization that regularly interacts with foreign persons, foreign government officials, foreign companies, including think tanks, media organizations, advocacy organizations, and the like. Of course, compliance with FARA is different for each situation and each company or entity. But generally, we like to recommend a FARA compliance program composed of three components. First, a FARA policy, a written FARA policy, in which the entity or company lays out its views on FARA and its controls around FARA and whether it will or will not trigger FARA. Second, a set of training and awareness programs conducted regularly, particularly amongst the government relations staff or the legal department or others who have overlap with issues that may implicate FARA. Importantly, in that training, we focus on raising awareness around the triggers and around the activities that may implicate FARA, and particularly when to seek counsel, either internally or externally, on issues that may trigger FARA. And then third component of a compliance policy is a system and process for handling issues that may implicate FARA. And then focusing on that last point for a moment, when the Department of Justice raises issues about FARA for companies, think tanks, trade associations, law firms, et cetera, the inquiries usually arise far after the fact. And so an important component of a FARA compliance program is setting up internal systems to handle and analyze issues that may raise FARA concerns and to document how you handle those issues, such as a request that may come in from a foreign government or an activity that may implicate a foreign interest. Corporate controls on activities that are undertaken related to foreign interests are very important. It's important to be able to demonstrate why a situation that may from the outside appear to implicate FARA didn't in fact. FARA inquiries from the Department of Justice are generally driven by media stories. The Department of Justice has a group of folks who regularly monitor news stories for issues that may implicate FARA and then send off inquiry letters if they decide to look into a situation. Of course, the media story that sparks the Department of Justice interest may not be accurate or complete, and your ability to demonstrate your compliance programs and the systems by which you handled issues that may implicate FARA is important. Lastly, in close cases, we encourage our clients to consider seeking an advisory opinion. As Rob mentioned, these are becoming more formal, and they are becoming a more regular part of the FARA practice. The advisory opinions that are published on the Department of Justice website are important guidance, but also they don't necessarily show the iterative relationship that may exist behind the final advisory opinion, in which the entity, company, individual has an opportunity to discuss the implications of a particular set of activities, perhaps revise their plans to ensure that they are FARA compliant and don't raise concerns with the Department of Justice. And so this advisory opinion process is an important part of considering a FARA compliance program. Importantly, the Department of Justice makes clear on its website that the advisory opinions may be guidance, but they are not precedents. And so in examining a particular set of facts and circumstances, it's important to consider whether an additional advisory opinion may be necessary for a particular case. Let me turn it back to Rob for closing.
Thanks, Brian. And we're going to finish up shortly and give the time back to you all. Let me just say a couple of points on compliance. With respect to the advisory opinions that Brian mentioned, clients often ask us how long it takes to get an advisory opinion. Won't they have to wait months to get one? And actually, in recent times, the department has been very quick at issuing advisory opinions, anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, I would say, on average. That may have been interrupted a bit by the government shutdown, but it is possible to get quite rapid guidance informally and even formal written opinions in a matter of weeks from the Department of Justice as a general matter. Brian mentioned the importance of having a FARA policy. I would just note that in recent years, many companies have adopted anti-corruption policies, FCPA policies, but they often leave out the U.S. side of that. So it deals with political activities overseas, it deals with corruption issues overseas, but often doesn't deal with the domestic mirror image of that. And I mention that because those global anti-corruption policies may present an opportunity, a vehicle, for you to add in a FARA policy in an existing larger company policy dealing with political activity around the world. With respect to training, I would note that particularly for FARA, it's important for your training program to be tailored to your unique circumstances. As you could hear today, there are a lot of black letter law principles under FARA that are going to be very sensitive to the facts and very sensitive to the unique circumstances of your company. So you'll want to design a FARA compliance training program that is tailored to your unique facts. I want to thank all of you for joining us. If we can help your company with FARA regulatory advice, obtaining advisory opinions, or defense in FARA-related investigations, we welcome the opportunity to speak with you. You can also follow developments under FARA on our blog, insidepoliticallaw.com. You can sign up for emails from the blog on the site, or follow FARA developments on our Twitter feed, at @CovPoliticalLaw, or sign up for email alerts on our website, cov.com, cov.com. Brian and I want to thank you very much for taking time to speak with us today about FARA. Have a good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.